Access number 2865-4, Mr. Leslie Gilbert, Reel 5. Now, before we go on, I think you wanted to talk a bit about your time in Cairo that you've just remembered since our last meeting.
Yes, that was before my first posting, which was to 458 Squadron. I was at a personnel holding centre near Cairo. We had nothing to do there. And so, and by the way, it was living in tents, and it was pure sand. I found this fascinating, just pure sand. But we were quite near Cairo, and as we had nothing much to do, we could go into Cairo if we wanted to in the afternoons. I think there was an electric train. I remember saying to one of the sergeants that I was surprised that there'd been bombing between where we were and Cairo, because we'd heard nothing at all about bombing when we were in Britain. We didn't know that Egypt had been bombed. He said, "What on earth are you talking about?" I said, "There are all these wrecks and shacks and bits of packing cases and people living in them." He said, "Oh, that's where the WOGs live. That's nothing to do with bombing." Anyway, in Cairo itself, it was divided into three zones as far as we servicemen were concerned. One zone we could just wander in freely. The second zone we could only go in if we were with other servicemen. And the third zone was completely forbidden to us. This was, I now know, before the Battle of Alamein, when there was a lot of belief in Egypt that the Germans would be arriving shortly, because they'd been pushing the Eighth Army back all the time. And there was no doubt about it, the Egyptians were looking forward to the Germans arriving, because they'd been so badly treated during the British occupation that they thought it could only be better under the Germans. The other thing I recollect about Cairo is the extraordinary gulf between the rich and the poor. We're accustomed to a certain amount of that in this country, and there was a lot of prejudice on the part of the British troops against the Egyptians, but it was nothing like the gulf between the wealthy Egyptians and the poor Egyptians. They were virtually two different nations. I found this quite an eye-opener. Anyway, now getting back to my 458 Squadron, which I returned to on Christmas Day, this was based at Shalufa, S-H-A-L-L-U-F-A, on the borders of the Suez Canal, or to be more exact, on the borders of the Little Bitter Lake of the Suez Canal. And I remember going swimming in the Little Bitter Lake. It was much more buoyant than being in the sea, although less buoyant than the Dead Sea, which I've also swum in. While I was there, a friend and I, another RAF chap, went on a week's leave to Palestine, and it was Palestine in those days, took the train to Tel Aviv, I think, and then toured around the country by bus. Tel Aviv itself, I remember, with modern buildings, modern white concrete things, not all that big at that time, and almost every building seemed to be occupied by doctors, nameplates on the houses. They were obviously German refugees. There must have been thousands and thousands of doctors in that place, probably looking after one another. We toured around, as I said, by bus, and my recollection is that the land was pretty empty. One saw Bedouins with their flocks of goats, and it was very, very rocky, stones all over the place in the fields. I could hardly imagine that cultivation could have taken place. I don't know how it came about, but we did visit a kibbutz, a collective farm, and what intrigued me more than anything else, and I've still got photographs, is the fact that I saw oranges growing on trees. I suppose I knew that they grew on trees, but of course I'd never seen such a thing. And I remember seeing a lorry piled up with thousands and thousands of oranges, This was at a time, of course, when we were getting virtually no fruit at all. So that's my main recollection of Palestine. Then, after a little while back on 458 Squadron, I was transferred to 38 Squadron Royal Air Force, not Royal Australian Air Force, which was also based at Shalufa.
Now, when was that? Do you have a date at all?
I think it was probably in about February 1943. After a little while...
Now, what were your first impressions of this unit? Did it differ much from your previous unit?
Yes, I'll tell you about that in a little while, because it'll fit in perhaps a bit better later on. After a very short time on the squadron in Shalufa, the whole squadron was moved to Burqa 3, south of Benghazi. Now, I had gone up to Burqa with 458, a detachment of 458 Squadron. Then I was flown up. This time, I was with the squadron, and which went up by road. And you have to realise that this squadron was virtually self-contained. It was really intended to be able to operate on its own. So there were lots and lots of kit and bits and pieces, and even a special light that was used to light up runways. Dozens and dozens of three-ton trucks, lorries, and it took several days, can't remember how many, but quite a number of days, on the road. There was and probably still is just one road from Egypt right through to Benghazi. This was, as I said, in about February 43, which would have been about 4 months after the Battle of Alamein. And we drove right through the Alamein battlefield, which was... I never saw any bodies. They'd obviously all been cleared away. But, oh, it was littered with wreckage all over the place. Tanks, armoured cars, everything. I've even got a photograph of myself sitting on a wrecked armoured car with an ammunition belt draped round my neck. And eventually we got to Burqa 3, and we set up our base there, ridge tents, three people to a tent. The climate was really quite horrible. It often got extremely hot, very hot indeed. It also sometimes rained, because it was on a bulge of Africa where it not true desert, and it did get rain. In order to get headroom in the tent, we dug down. We made a kind of pit, and of course this then got flooded. There were no creature comforts at all. We had no lighting. There was no washing arrangements. One had to tramp a long way to get water. Because of mosquitoes, we had to sleep under mosquito nets, and these were very heavy, thick cotton things, which were quite horrible. There were scorpions around, and you learned to just empty your shoes. We had shoes, by the way, not boots, before putting them on. We fixed up rudimentary beds, knocked up bits and pieces of wood and so on to keep off the ground and away from the scorpions. And one day the adjutant of the squadron came round, saw these other ranks sleeping on beds, unlike officers, and ordered that all the beds were to be removed and we were to get back to sleeping like other ranks on the ground. But apparently there was a big bust-up, because the medical officer didn't want the chaps stung by scorpions, and so the order was rescinded. We also ran into, there was a locust plague on one occasion, and this was utterly horrible. you couldn't walk around without these things striking your face. They were all over the place, and they had an unpleasant habit of eating one another, which didn't actually appeal to us. And in the mess tent, we ate in a big marquee. These things would be on the roof inside, and every now and again they'd drop down into your food. I talked about the mosquitoes. At sunset, the mosquitoes disappeared like magic, and then the flies came out like magic, and they were perhaps even worse than the mosquitoes somehow. God knows where these flies came from, out in that kind of area, but they were just clouds and clouds of these things. Now the squadron, the job of the squadron,
They were in Wellingtons as well, were they?
Yes, so same Wellingtons with the same kind of radar. One important job was escorting convoys that were going through the Mediterranean, because there were still German submarines in the Mediterranean, and there was always one of our planes flying round and round the convoy, looking out for submarines. I think by that time the Germans knew how to detect the radar of a patrolling aircraft when it was switched on, so they would send up an aerial. They would be submerged, but they could get an aerial up on the surface, and that would pick up the signal from the aircraft, which kept the submarine down and out of harm's way. So this was actually quite useful. So our planes used to go out on, they spent about 7 hours relieved one after another. All other types of operations were torpedo bombing, torpedo attacks on German shipping in the eastern Mediterranean. The Germans were using ships to, they were still occupying Greece, and they used small ships to send supplies to all the little islands off the mainland, and our squadron would try to attack these ships.
Could Wellingtons drop torpedoes?
Oh yes. I'll show you a photograph later on if you like. This was quite an achievement, apparently, fitting the Wellington up. The Bombay could take two torpedoes side by side. And another type of operation was where the plane would carry 500-pound bombs, which they would use to try to destroy ships. Now, I was going to say something about the squadron. You see, there were on the squadron a number of... most of the men there were regulars. They'd been in the RAF for years. The radar mechanics were all new people, because there'd been no radar until quite recently. I think that a number of the fellows had been on probably 90 squadron in Iraq, which they called Mesopotamia. And they loved talking about the planes, which in those days were little biplanes, flying around, dropping bombs on the wogs, as they called them, and the wogs on camels trying to shoot fire back with ancient rifles. Talking about this now makes one realize that the Iraqis must have, some of them with long memories, must still remember that kind of thing and the way they were treated. But because they'd been in the RAF so long, and also on the same squadrons, there was a great sense of camaraderie among the men. And there was no military discipline whatsoever. I can't remember a single parade, for example, while we were up in Libya. If we came across an officer, we wouldn't dream of saluting him. He wouldn't dream of expecting to be saluted. It was very much like civilian life. You might wonder how it was that the squadron operated without any military discipline. And I think the answer was twofold. Firstly, we knew literally that the lives of the aircrew were in our hands. If those planes were not properly maintained, then the aircrew were going to suffer, obviously. And the second reason was that we knew we were doing a useful job of work. For example, when an aircraft came back from an operation, the aircrew between them had to complete a checklist while commenting on various bits and pieces of equipment in case something needed servicing. Now, time and again, the radar operator would fill in the form and say, "Excellent, thank you." And that somehow was worth a great deal, the fact that our work was being appreciated in that way. I can, by the way, remember an incident which didn't do the radar operator in the aircraft any good at all. I explained earlier on that these Wellingtons had aerials under the wings pointing forward and aerials on top which looked sideways. So when the plane was flying along and the radar operator was operating, he would switch the transmitter so that it was transmitting forward, and then he had to switch separately the receiver to pick up. Not one switch, but two switches. Then if he wanted to look sideways instead, he had to switch the transmitter to the sideways viewing and the receiver to the sideways viewing. One night when I was on duty, because we had 24-hour rotors, plane that had gone out to convoy a ship, to patrol a convoy, radioed it was coming back to base because the radar was not operating, and the radar was essential. So they had to scramble a replacement Wellington and crew, and I went out onto the airfield to meet this disabled plane when it came back. I went in, had a look, and the problem was a very simple one. The radar operator, when he switched, he'd only switched the transmitter and not the receiver. I should think he was probably told off about this later on. Another interesting aspect of the equipment. Now, this is a bit technical, but I rather think that something interesting might have come out of it. The radar transmitter, was set to a particular frequency, or 176 megahertz, megacycles as we called them. Now, the transmitter had a pair of klystrons, and each klystron was attached to a Lecker line. The Lecker line was actually a hollow tube of maybe, I don't know, a foot or so long. And these two Leckers were perhaps 6 inches apart or less. Now, to each of them, there was attached a disc about an inch and a half in diameter, the two discs facing one another, with air spacing in between, acting as an air-spaced capacitor. One of the discs was simply bolted to its Lecker line. The other disc was on a threaded rod, so it could be screwed in and out, and that varied the separation between the two discs, and therefore varied the frequency. Each time we checked the radar in an aircraft, we had to check the frequency of the transmitter. We did that using what was called a wave meter, actually a frequency meter. This thing was not all that large, but it was enormously heavy, I think because of its batteries. Now, how did we get it inside the aircraft? Well, this was, of course, a military plane, not a civilian plane, and the way of getting in and out was via a small trapdoor near just by the nose of the aircraft, underneath, And the trapdoor would be lowered, and then the air crew could get a hold of a ladder, small steel ladder, which was inside, lower it down onto the ground, and they could climb up and down. That was the way we mechanics had to get in and out of the aircraft. And that was the way we had to take all our equipment in and out. And manhandling the wave meter was no great fun, especially as the inside of the aircraft, when it was standing on the ground in full sun, used to get appallingly hot, quite indescribably hot. Now, the frequency of the transmitter wandered, not a great deal, but it did wander, and we had to retune it. This was not easy. The way it had to be done was to screw that variable disc, the movable disc, in and out. Now, you couldn't do it directly because there was 20,000 volts on the Lecker line. There was a hole in the side of the transmitter, and one inserted a plastic tool in. In those days, I think it was Bakelite. That was just about the only plastic there was. Inserted that in until it engaged with the movable disc, and then one screwed the disc in and out and watched the wave meter and adjusted the frequency accordingly. This was not a pleasant arrangement, but there was more to it than that. I said it was very hot in the aircraft, even with our shirts off and just wearing shorts, we'd be dripping with perspiration. And on one occasion, one of our chaps had somehow got the tuning tool wet with his sweat. He put the thing in and he got 20,000 volts. I was there at the time. It didn't kill him because simply and solely because the current was so low. If the current had been greater, he would have been killed. He was literally shocked. I mean, he went totally white. He was shaking. We had to drag him out of the aircraft. He was able to stand outside shaking, and he muttered, "Cigarette," and we stuck a cigarette between his lips and lit it for him. Then we realised there was 100 octane fuel dripping out of the fuel tank of the wing above us, so we took him away. Anyway, that was the kind of thing that went on with this wretched retuning. One day we had a meeting in our workshop where the officer came along, the radar officer, and we were talking about things, and the question of the retuning came up. And I said it was silly to have to retune the transmitter every time. The sergeant said, "Don't tell the officer he's silly." The officer, fortunately, I still remember his name, Pilot Officer Murray, he said, no, never mind, let him go on. What do you think we should do instead? I said, well, there must be some reason for the frequency drifting. Now, as this is an air-spaced capacitor, condenser, that controls the fine frequency, it's got to be something to do with that, something to do with the air. He said, well, what could it be? I said, I don't know, pressure, temperature, humidity. So I made a proposal. I said, one of our aircraft is grounded because it's waiting for a spare part to be flown out from Britain. It'll be on the ground for about a fortnight. Why don't we measure the frequency every day, but don't change it, just record it? And if you, sir, could get meteorological information from the Met station, the naval Met station in Benghazi, I would then have a look and see if there was any correlation. So we did this. He got hold of readings for temperature, air pressure and humidity, and I graphed these against the variation in frequency, and the frequency variation and the humidity variation correlated precisely. So the frequency changes were due to the humidity changes in the atmosphere, and it wasn't worth retuning the radar every time we tested it. Shortly afterwards, Pilot Officer Murray was promoted. I don't know whether he reported his discovery to headquarters. Certainly I got no comeback from it. I think it was quite an interesting observation, actually.
Now, anything else you were doing? This is all on the same radio. I've forgotten the number of it. It's the AV radio.
ASV.
ASV, yeah.
ASV. Air to surface vessels. Yes. It was all on the same radar. Yeah.
Now, anything else about your work there?
Not about the... Well, I was talking about the lack of what we call bullshit. I remember there was one occasion that there were horrible dust storms. I haven't mentioned these, apart from the mosquitoes, the flies and the locusts and the scorpions. That bit of Africa was being rapidly blown away. I think what had happened was that the Italian colonists had tried to set up their kind of agriculture there, and this meant ploughing, and it loosened up the topsoil, and whenever it got windy, the topsoil started blowing away. There was agriculture going on by the locals, and they were, I don't know what crop, what cereal they were growing, but it was so sparse that the way they harvested it was just to crouch down and use a little scythe and cut the stalks more or less in four or five at a time. And the winnowing was done by piling all this stuff up, putting a large piece of wood on top, and getting a donkey to pull the wool, the wood round and round and round. And then when it got windy, the men would simply throw all the stuff up in the air, and the chaff would come straight down and the seeds would blow away. So that was the level of agriculture there. I was going to talk about something else and I've forgotten what it was now in connection with agriculture. Did I start saying?
No.
I don't
drainage.
Know. No. Or maybe that was the point that I was trying to make. The only other thing I would say I remember of any interest, in a way, I suppose, is that Benghazi itself, which I believe now is a rather a fine city, was an utter and complete wreck. We used to go in there, and it had been, when it hadn't been bombed by the Germans, it had been bombed by the British, and there were wrecked ships in the harbour. It was altogether not a very pleasant place.
Was there anything to do there when you went in there?
Nothing at all. The only reason we ever went in was to get a bit of white bread. Goodness knows how the Libyans had managed to produce white bread, but they had. But no, there was this squadron. We were just out of civilization altogether. There were no bars. There was no baths. There was nothing to do except go swimming. The Med wasn't far away. On one occasion, after I'd swum, I lay on the beach in the blazing sun and I got heat stroke. I was very sick and very giddy. I was dragged off to the sick bay, which was a tent, larger marquee. I was put between sheets, which was a very, very pleasant. And I was given a special medicine, namely a mug of water with a lot of salt dissolved in it. That was the thing. I tried appearing less well than I was because I was enjoying it there, but they threw me out after a while. While I was there, up in Libya, I went on a week's leave back to Cairo, flew back to Cairo. One had the opportunity, and I wish so much now I'd taken it, from Cairo, of going up the Nile to the great... ruins. The wife of the British ambassador was organising trips, but all I wanted to do was to have a comfortable bed in a nice hotel with sheets and with cold water and with cinemas and things like that. So places like, what's it, Luxor and Karnak, is it? Yeah, those places which I could have visited.
You never saw the pyramids?
No. I saw the pyramids. Oh, yes.
You went to
I said that I was based for a little while outside Cairo.
You went there.
And I went there. I saw them. Yes, I was the only person. If you can imagine, I saw the pyramids all by myself and the Sphinx. And on the way back, I can remember on an electric tram, I was the only non-Egyptian there, and the Egyptians were making what were obviously unpleasant comments about this English serviceman. Oh yes, and by the way, when I was in Greece, which I'll come to later on, I went to the Acropolis.
Well,
yes, and similarly, hardly anybody there.